The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
Good evening. It's 6 minutes after 7, and this is 91.3 KUAF. A listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And your home for Of Note with Katie Henriksen, beginning in about an hour. Tonight, Katie welcomes Urgene Kong to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss Urgene's upcoming concert with the Arkansas Philharmonic in Bentonville this weekend, and Urgene's brand new recording of music composed by Arkansas native Florence Price. That conversation and great classical music begins at 8 on 91.3. And this is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday evening, February 13th, 2018. Happy Fat Tuesday. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later tonight, John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, considers what an increase in the number of Arkansas Democrats seeking office means for 2018 and beyond. That's in about a dozen minutes. And later tonight, an exploration and explanation of how immigration works in the United States. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda will bring us that. First tonight, four counties in Arkansas are working to establish crisis stabilization centers to divert people with mental health emergencies from jail. The program was established through a bill that passed the state legislature last year, and it's slowly coming online in Washington and Sebastian counties. Sebastian County is also working to create a sobering center where they could divert people with substance abuse emergencies, again, to keep them out of jail and get them into treatment. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek has this update.
Consider this fact.
The county was going to build onto the county jail, added an additional 1,000 beds about 12 years ago. We never did do that.
That's Leon Evans talking about the jail in Bexar County, Texas. In that time, Evans says the county has grown by about 500,000 people, but the jail has stayed hundreds of inmates under capacity.
Well, I tell people we're a 17-year overnight success.
That's how long Evans worked with San Antonio's Center for Healthcare Services to establish a crisis center for psychiatric and substance abuse emergencies.
We've developed this place called the Restoration Center that has a sobering unit, a detox unit, and a mental health crisis unit.
Now that crisis center is a model for the rest of the country. And Evans, who retired from his role at the center last April, is a consultant. He's been working with Sebastian County Judge David Hudson and Sheriff Bill Hollenbeck on their effort to establish a crisis stabilization unit and sobering center in Fort Smith.
And for years, they've been researching this, and they're some of the most progressive people I know.
The CSU will be in one of the buildings on the Western Arkansas Counseling and Guidance Center campus. Hudson says after some delays and a redesign, the unit will open later this month and will likely start accepting patients shortly after that. Hudson says work on establishing a sobering center is also underway.
It's a diversion initiative to divert individuals that are arrested for intoxication, and rather than booking them into the county jail to sober up, to divert them from being in the jail environment at all to another facility where they could sober up and then perhaps be connected to follow-up services.
The CSU will operate similarly. Police will bring a patient to the 16-bed facility at Western Arkansas Counseling and Guidance Center. That person will stay in the care of medical staff for 1 to 2 days, and then they'll be offered a long-term treatment plan. Here's Hudson.
It's kind of a watershed of the shift of importance to treat the mentally ill, which needed to happen. It's needed to happen for a number of years. So it's exciting that we're there. It's also challenging.
One of the challenges is making sure law enforcement officers are trained to recognize mental health and substance abuse crises. Sheriff Bill Hollenbeck says training sessions have been held across the state. Most recently, there was a 40-hour seminar in Fort Smith that included role-playing.
Quite frankly, at first, you know, our local law enforcement went into it with, okay, here we go. Why are we here? Because, you know, quite frankly, throughout the years, law enforcement has been called upon to deal with social issues more and more and more. And here's one more area of concern.
But Hollenbeck says after the week-long training session, he saw a turnaround, and he acknowledges the process will take some time. Because at the end of the day, the CSU and the Sobering Center are about changing the criminal justice system in Arkansas.
One of the biggest components to make this successful is the training for the law enforcement officers. You know, having that paradigm shift of learning that and recognizing that if somebody has a mental health issue, jail is not the place for them.
And Hollenbeck is coming from a city that has already shifted its approach. Before he became sheriff, Hollenbeck was part of the Dallas Police Department, where they had a detox center.
You know, right now, the state of Arkansas looks at being intoxicated as a crime. Well, you know, maybe it's a medical emergency as well.
The same Hollenbeck says goes for someone who may have committed a crime during a mental health crisis.
You know, most other states in the country have some sort of mental health, you know, stabilization units that law enforcement, especially in bigger cities, can utilize. So, you know, you get to face the fact that, gosh, man, we're 49th in the nation on this one as well. So do we want to be that way or do we want to change?
Hollenbeck says he's heard the argument that this kind of approach to law enforcement is coming from a liberal point of view, but he doesn't see it that way.
I think it's a conservative viewpoint as well. I mean, do you want, you know, 3 or 4 days in stabilization unit versus maybe 10 years in prison? What's cheaper? What's more expensive? And we know the answer.
Judge Hudson agrees. He says the CSU and Sobering Center are part of a smarter justice system, which entails smarter use of taxpayer money.
It doesn't really seem to matter how large a jail is built, how many beds a jail offers. The criminal justice system is very effective. Law enforcement does a great job of arrests, you know, and conviction through the system, through the prosecuting attorney and the justice system. We're very good at that. The issue is it costs money to hold people in jails. It costs money to treat the folks that are in jail.
Hudson says the goal should be to keep dangerous and violent offenders behind bars. But those who aren't should be considered for alternative treatment that will give them the opportunity to stabilize their lives. The long-term results, he says, are just better.
That's the bottom line, and frankly, we're faced with that right now. Is our jail too small? Do we need to enlarge the jail? Will diversion programs allow the jail population to be sufficient? That's an outstanding question right now in Sebastian County.
Hudson says alternative treatment gives people the best chance of becoming contributing members of their community. Otherwise, Sheriff Hollenbeck adds, there's evidence many will continue to cycle through the justice system after that first arrest.
Once you're introduced to the criminal justice system, let's say even for a nonviolent misdemeanor offense, you're 30% more likely to reoffend. Also, 30% of the people in the Arkansas Department of Correction, statistically, they started out with some sort of mental health issue, and then it escalated into a felony type of situation, and now they're going to prison.
For now, the CSU will be funded through a $1.6 million grant from the state and will take in patients from 6 counties. Judge Hudson says those patients will not be charged for services.
The actual budgeting is something that we're looking at as far as the grant money, how much reimbursement will be able to be achieved through available insurance or Medicaid, and if there's any gap. And if there's any gap, then how are we going to address the gap? Probably as a local government unit.
Hudson says they will file monthly reports with the governor and legislature to track the CSU's progress, which ideally will encourage the state to expand the program to other counties.
These changes to the criminal justice system are very hard to make, and it's hard to shift money. And so it's very important that the voting public observes what's going on, understand the issue. Because it is a change in policy.
And Hudson and Hollenbeck both say the public will have to buy into the change, because if the program is successful, Sebastian County will have to figure out how to fund it after the grant runs out. Here's the sheriff.
The monies that have been allocated for this probably won't last forever. So I think the community, business leaders and private individuals can help as well.
In Bexar County, Texas, Leon Evans says the results have driven investment from the county, the city of San Antonio, and private donations. Since Evans became involved with the Center for Healthcare Services in 2000, the agency's annual budget has grown to more than $100 million. Evan says about 2,300 people a month come through the restoration center, and after they're stabilized, they're offered treatment options.
In the sobering unit, we have people in recovery. We use evidence-based kind of treatment, and we try to get people to agree to go to detox. which is in the same building. And about 20% of those folks a month historically have agreed to go to detox.
After they detox, Evan says patients are offered in-house recovery. To be on the main campus, though, they have to be drug and alcohol free and have to work 8 hours a day, whether that's going to school or maintaining the campus.
But it's a 120-day program, so you're there long enough that your brain chemistry starts healing up. You start thinking better. You start figuring out what in the heck you've done to your children, your family, your friends, yourself.
Evan says half of the people who go through the program are sober a year later. And in the last 17 years, Bexar County has seen an 80% drop in the number of homeless people in San Antonio's downtown. And visits to emergency rooms and incarceration rates are both down.
The other thing I encourage people to do is go ahead and do your baseline now, because what you're going to find is things aren't working very well. And once you start these programs, they're going to start working well, and you'll see great improvements, and that gets people excited about continuing the work.
Sebastian County, of course, is just starting the work, but Sheriff Hollenbeck says the foundation is there.
We cannot be at war with our society, and our society right now has a small portion of our society has a drug problem. So we got to face it, and if we keep locking them up and have this, you know, throw everybody in jail, lock them up, lock them up, lock them up, and conviction, we're going to continue to go the route that we've been going, you know, for the last 30 years. And I think we need to open our eyes a little bit and change our thought process.
Because all three men agree, it's the right thing to do, not only to improve officer and public safety, but to help those in the community who are struggling. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
The Sebastian County Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee met this afternoon. Judge David Hudson's, as part of their discussion, focused on whether the current legislation authorizes the creation of a sobering center or whether new legislation has to be passed. The county would also have to partner with another agency to facilitate a sobering center. There was discussion about involving Riverview Hope Campus. However, the director tells us that while they would be able to take in intoxicated people who are nonviolent, they would not be able to provide medical oversight.
91.3 is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, presenting the U.S. debut of Soul of a Nation, Art in the Age of Black Power. It's on display now through April, featuring works by more than 60 artists. It looks at how American culture was reshaped by black artists from the 1960s through the 80s. More information at crystalbridges.org. Additional support comes from Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include American College of Radiology certified imaging departments, infusion centers, pharmacy, clinical trials, and more. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com.
The 2018 election grows closer each day. We are fewer than 100 days away from voters selecting party nominees in Arkansas on May 22nd. And we know something's a bit different this year than recent primaries in Arkansas. Democrats are populating many primary races with more than just one candidate. Now, by any measure, Arkansas is a Republican state, with every constitutional officer a Republican, every member of Arkansas's Washington delegation selected by voters a Republican, and the GOP has a solid majority in both chambers of the state legislature. This week, Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, asked John Brummett, political writer of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, about the increase in Democratic Party hopefuls. For example, Roby says, three candidates are vying for that party's nomination in Arkansas's 2nd Congressional District for the right to challenge Republican incumbent French Hill.
Clark Tucker officially in, as we were speaking last week, he was stepping in. Paul Spencer, Gwen Combs in for the Democratic primary for the right to challenge Republican Representative French Hill. It sounds like we may be headed towards a spirited primary. Is that good?
Yes, it's good. It's also, you referred to my column, I think in a message to me, you said you referred to my education on the issue. And I thought that was well put. I don't want to go on too much about this, but politics is so volatile right now. that the rules one will tend to apply when one has been covering it for 40 years, and which always works so well, sometimes cannot be exactly right these days. And it helps an old guy like me to learn a new lesson. I remember last year for your magazine, I went out and I said, let me go find some Trump supporters and figure out what's going on out there. And I thought, I've got to go find the weirdest looking people I can find. I've got to find the fringe people. All I need to do was walk out, and the first person I saw would likely have been a Trump supporter. He got more than 60% of the vote. The weird, the outer became not so outer. Here, Clark Tucker, I've watched him in the legislature. He's incredibly accomplished. He's got all the credentials, but I sort of prematurely anointed him as the likely, if not certain, nominee. Gwen Combs organized the women's movement, which gets to be a little bit of a bigger thing every day, and she has no standard credential. She simply has passion for an issue and a movement at her disposal. Paul Spencer, at Catholic High, is a guy who has no office holding credential. His traditional resume doesn't exist, except he has led citizens' initiatives for ethics reform, trying to get money out of politics, and it is possible. Gwen Combs made a point. She got nothing against Clark Tucker, but if he's the nominee, you're going to have two guys in business suits, a lawyer and a banker, running, and the difference may not be distinct to voters. Will be with her. Now, I'm not prepared to say Tucker will not be the nominee. But I am prepared to say that, yes, that there are things happening out there that change the way I have traditionally looked at politics. And it's not entirely new. One of Clark Tucker's credentials is he's Harvard educated. Well, I have referred to the Harvard qualification of Governor Bill Bristow and U.S. Senator Nate Coulter. It didn't.
And Senator Tom Cotton and former Governor Jim Guy Tucker.
Well, there's two who won, but two who lost.
Right.
So and particularly in this environment, that might not be that much of an advantage. So and the other thing, and I made this point in concluding the column. 4 years ago, you remember Mike Ross, they talked him into running for governor. Mm-hmm. The Democrats did. Bill Halter wanted to run, and Democrats said, oh, no, we can't, no, because we've got to not spend money and not be damaged and not be divisive in the primary. How'd that turn out? Not so good.
Right.
This is more fluid. This is more real. This is more gritty. This is more like a party. You've got three vigorous candidates, two with a great deal of passion, the other with a great deal of competence. And let's just get out there and see.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns can also be read at ArkansasOnline.com. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. There is much more to their conversation, including their latest thoughts about the just underway fiscal session of the Arkansas Legislature at TalkBusiness.net. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. In about 4 minutes, immigration procedures examined and explained. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson is calling for tax cuts for the state's wealthiest earners. He announced the proposal as he addressed lawmakers yesterday at the beginning of the fiscal session of the Arkansas Legislature. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek of Arkansas Public Media reports the cuts wouldn't be put into law until 2019.
Governor Asa Hutchinson told state lawmakers details of his tax cut plan at the start of this year's fiscal session. He wants a $180 million annual tax cut for the state's highest earners.
We need to reduce the individual income tax rate in Arkansas.
Hutchinson says the goal is to compete with other states for business investors. He says recently at a meeting with the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, he was asked how much top earners pay in state taxes.
And I said, well, it's 6.9%. And they looked at me and responded, that is worse than Connecticut.
State Senator Linda Chesterfield of Little Rock says she's afraid tax cuts will send Arkansas in the direction of Kansas or Oklahoma, struggling to pay for services like teachers and law enforcement.
And those cuts we can't afford right now because Arkansas is not a state that has lots of money, but we've got to make sure that we maintain funding for education. We've got to make sure that we maintain funding for health centers, job training. We right now are challenged as far as highway monies are concerned.
Democrats are a minority in the state legislature. Republican State Senator Jim Hendren from Gravatt is the chair of a task force hashing out the details of such tax cuts. He says he wants taxes to be as low as possible. He says his task force has met with lawmakers from Oklahoma and Kansas to learn how to avoid such pitfalls. For example, they say give tax cuts for a set period. Don't plan them into the future when the economy might decline.
Be careful about passing tax cuts over a future 3 or 4 year period so that we can all go out and pound our chest that we passed $200 million tax cut, even though we did 50-50-50-50 over 5 years or 4 years. Well, in 2 or 3 years, if the economy dramatically changes, you may not have that $50 million that you approved 3 years ago.
The task force expects to have a report by September. The governor's $180 million proposed cuts for high earners would need legislative approval during the 2019 session. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, Arkansas Public Media.
As the fiscal session begins at the Capitol, there are questions looming about whether there will be enough support to keep the state's hybrid Medicaid expansion for another year. Governor Hutchinson says he expects before the session is over to get word that the Trump administration is approving changes the governor would like to make to the Arkansas Works program.
We are all watching the cost, I know. And the most effective cost control is helping people be trained and to earn their way off. And while our work requirement will be one of the most stringent in the country, it is not designed to be punitive, but to increase training and opportunities for employment.
The governor also says he plans to support a working group to propose regulatory reductions on state businesses. The city of Siloam Springs has made it into a top five race to be featured on the third season of Hulu's The Small Business Revolution. Siloam Springs is competing against towns in Illinois, Massachusetts, Texas, and California for $500,000 to stimulate downtown revitalization. The program, distributed by Hulu, is about helping set up small businesses for long-term sustainability. Now, in order to make it all the way, the public will be required to vote. Online voting will be open for the next 7 days at smallbusinessrevolution.com. The group Main Street Arkansas is reporting more than $68 million was invested in downtowns of Arkansas cities in 2017. A press release notes more than 200 downtown businesses received facade renovation or underwent construction improvements last year in cities involved with Main Street Arkansas. And those projects represented a net gain of more than 500 jobs. Main Street Arkansas is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. Cities in western and northwest Arkansas involved with Main Street Arkansas include Eureka Springs, Ozark, Rogers, Siloam Springs, Fort Smith, Ozark, and Paris. A new study from Morning Consult indicates President Trump's approval rating among registered Arkansas voters is still above 50%, but has slipped a bit since this time last year. The report places the president's approval rating in Arkansas at 53%, down from 59% in January 2017. Arkansans' disapproving of his work increased over the last 12 months from 29% to the current 40% disapproving. Arkansas's voters' approval ratings for the president are among the top 10 highest in the country. And Ozark Regional Transit is altering routes in Benton County and reducing the frequency of an express route on Interstate 49 beginning next week. Routes that are exclusively inside the cities of Rogers and Bentonville, routes 11, 51, and 52, will end an hour and a half earlier each day, and the express on I-49 will be reduced from 2 buses to 1 bus each day, affecting frequency. The changes take effect Monday.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra welcomes violinist Ergene Kong Saturday, February 17th at the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. Under the direction of maestro Stephen Bias, Kong and the APO will perform Violin Concerto No. 2 of Arkansas composer Florence Beatrice Price. ArkansasPhilharmonic.org for tickets.
With the most recent government shutdown behind them, members of Congress are turning their attention this week to the issue of immigration. A focal point of the discussion is deferred action for childhood arrivals, or DACA. The program, which provides protected status to undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children, will end March 5th. If Congress doesn't act by that deadline, what legal options do DACA recipients have, if any? Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda recently traveled to the Springdale office of immigration lawyer Laura Ferner to find out more.
Opponents of these kids, I guess now adults, getting a pathway to citizenship often say things like, well, if they've been here this long, sure, it's their parents' fault that they got here. But, you know, why haven't they taken action? Why haven't they applied for citizenship? Why haven't they filed paperwork? I think the short answer is that there's not a pathway to citizenship, or they don't have a lot of options. Is that correct?
Yes. And so just to clarify, before citizenship, there's always another step that's called legal permanent residency. And that is just incredibly hard to obtain unless you have somebody who can apply for you. Usually that is a parent who's here as a resident themselves, or a U.S. citizen, or a spouse. So unless you have those, you cannot become a resident here in the United States. Now, for some of those dreamers, now if DACA ends and now it hasn't ended, there might be other avenues, and I think most of them are exploring those options on a professional level. For some of them, there might be options, but for many, there aren't, and that is because they were brought here without permission, so they entered what we call entry without inspection. And with that, that means that they don't have a legal entry to the United States, which often bars them from applying for any sort of residency status here in the United States.
Does that still apply if they did come here legally? Because sometimes you can come here, say on a visa, but you overstay your visa, so now you are undocumented, correct?
Yes. So for those people, it can change a little bit depending on who's going to apply for you. If you're married to a U.S. citizen and they apply for you, then if you overstayed your visa, you can become a resident. But that's sort of the misconception that most people have, is why haven't they applied for legal status if they have lived here in the United States? And I always like to tell, I don't think anybody would like to live in the shadows, would like to be in constant fear of being arrested or being deported or having their family torn apart if there was a legal way to do it. And that's the problem. Most people just don't have a way to become legal, quote unquote. And so in order to stick with family, for family unity reasons, to have a better life for their family, to be able to feed their family, they come here and then they try and try and try. And, you know, Congress promises there are ways, but there just aren't.
So for the very few people that might say have an option, one of those options I think you see in movies, somebody's here without documentation and they marry somebody and, you know, romantic comedy ensues or something. That the notion that you can just marry a citizen to become a resident or a citizen, is that an option?
Not as easily as it sounds. It's not just a matter of marrying somebody and boom, you're a resident. There are steps you have to take. You have to see, do you qualify to apply for residency here in the United States, or do you have to do that by going back to your home country? Now, if you spend any time in the United States since you turned 18 without permission, you accrue something called unlawful presence. And when you leave the country and you have accrued more than 1 year of unlawful presence, you can't come back for 10 years. So there are those sort of complications and issues that come up. And then there's a immigration history. So, for example, if you were a child and you came across the border with your aunt, I don't know, or some random person, and they smuggled you across the border and you were 5 years old, but the aunt, you were stopped at the border and the aunt said, hey, she's a U.S. citizen. Now you have a false claim to U.S. citizenship and you might be barred for life from applying for residency forever.
Even though you weren't the one that said anything?
Correct.
I've heard proponents say, well, why don't you go home and then come back the right way? Well, the problem with that is, like you said, is sometimes that could be a 10-year wait or not at all, correct?
That's correct. Same with if you have a legal permanent resident father that applied for you when you were about 16 years old, the wait time at that time maybe was 2 years, but all of a sudden it jumps to about 6 or 7 years. Meanwhile, you turn 21, now your wait time has increased, if you're from Mexico, has increased to about 20, 22 years.
Why has it increased?
Because you are part of a, it's a sort of quota system. It's the visa bulletin. There's a certain number of visas available from each category each year. And so if you fall into one of those categories, your wait time just might be that long.
So if a country maybe is, I don't know if more popular is the right word, but more applications are coming from there.
Like the countries that have their own category, and I'll pull up the visa bulletin for you in a second and we can look at that. If you are from Mexico, India, or the Philippines, you have your own category, and the wait times are just incredibly long. And that, like, as for us immigration advocates, the term chain migration that has been thrown around lately by especially Republican pundits in this administration is quite infuriating. Because there is no such thing as chain migration. It's family-based immigration, and you can only apply for immediate relatives. There are no applications available for cousins and uncles and distant relatives, as some people like to say.
So chain migration is not the legal term?
Absolutely not. We like to think of it as more of a racist term, actually.
As I think it was in the State of the Union that the president mentioned that as part of his immigration reform, he would like to limit who you can sponsor. Like he said, right now, he said that you can bring distant relatives, cousins, and things like that, but that's actually not the way that it is.
Absolutely not. You can only apply for your children or your spouse, and if you are a U.S. citizen, then you can apply for your brother or sister.
Can you apply for that immediate family as a U.S. citizen if, say, my sister came here from Mexico, for example, without documentation? Can I apply for her if she's here without documentation, or does she have to be in her home country in order for me to apply for her?
You can apply for her, but then the wait for her to actually get her residency is about 20 years. And then because if she came here without permission at that time and she's not in legal status, she will most likely have to go back and get her residency or visa that way. And when she leaves, she can't come back for 10 years. So then we're adding about 30 years to the wait.
So, if you're here without documentation, you can be sponsored by your family. But as you mentioned, it would be even longer. Mm-hmm. You can marry someone, but it's not instant. Can you be sponsored through work?
Yes and no. Yes, you can. There are a limited number of work visas or different types of visas for employers to sponsor employees in the more educated category, or there's like a specialty occupation called H-1B visa, and those are for people with advanced degrees that have a specialty occupation that there is a need for employees in this country. So often that is software engineers or nurses even have their own category right now because we have a shortage of nurses in this country. And then, of course, physicians, if they work in a low-income area, for example. And then there's, like, people of extraordinary ability. Those are, like, your physics, neuroscience professors, those types of people. And then there are what we call H-2B visas. Those are for low-skill workers, and those are usually a bigger employer applies for those. But those are only for people who are in their home country and then come here. So for somebody who is here because they now have come here without permission and have accrued unlawful presence, they do not qualify for those types of visas.
The H-B2 visas?
Mm-hmm.
H-2B.
H-2B,
excuse mm-hmm. me. And the other visa, the H-1B, mm-hmm. Can you apply for that if you were here? Because in theory, someone who was under DACA could have gone to a university and gotten a degree as a nurse or as a highly skilled worker of some sort, and so they could have that degree in a possibly?
Maybe. Okay. The answer is maybe. There's too many factors to consider, like how did they enter the country? Did they accrue unlawful presence since turning 18? And those types of things that you would have to look at to see if they qualify for that. Most likely, they would have to go back to their home country and obtain the visa over there. But an employer could petition for them, and if they haven't, if they were under 18 when they got DACA, they did not accrue unlawful presence, so they wouldn't have a bar from coming back necessarily.
But they would still have to go back to their home country to get that sponsored visa?
Correct, that because of the unlawful entry.
Another possible option that I have heard of is a U visa. Can you kind of explain what that is?
A U visa is it's a specific crime visa for victims of crime. It is the purpose of that visa was to encourage people to come forward and report crimes that were committed against them, because there's always been the fear in the immigrant community that especially victims of domestic violence and other violent crimes would not come forward to report crimes because they were afraid of being taken in by the police. Now, in order to qualify for a U visa, you have to have been a victim and you have to have reported this to the police or to the authorities, and you must have been helpful in the investigation. So, for example, a woman who was a victim of domestic violence, the neighbors called the police and she was beaten up horribly and then is too scared to testify or cooperate with the police would not qualify for a U visa. But I have to say, around here, especially in Springdale, that the local authorities have been pretty helpful in facilitating the U visa. And the first step to that is always we have to get a certification from the local agency, so the police or the prosecutor's office, to show that the victim was helpful in the investigation. And we, generally speaking, have been pretty successful at that.
So it's a very complicated system. Are there any other possible avenues that someone who is here without documentation might be able to explore?
No, not really right now. I mean, it's always worth talking to an expert or an attorney that specializes in immigration law, because there's so many little things to consider that, you know, maybe you're grandparents apply for your parents and maybe you now can qualify for that. I don't know. It just sort of, there's so many what ifs, and every case, every detail of every case makes such a big difference in the trajectory, which way the case can go. But it's always worth talking to people, but often I do tell people that I can't do a whole lot for them at this very time, at this very moment.
There's no easy fix, but as someone who does work in the immigration system, what are things or what are changes that you think would be helpful to the system?
I mean, there are certain things that I think would be easy to implement, and I'm not saying easy fixes, but easy to implement. For example, it would be great to for people who have TPS right now, for example, that is ending, prior to them getting TPS, a lot of people qualified for something called NACARA, or people that came in the early 90s from Central America and had met certain qualifications qualified for something called NACARA, and they still had to show that they had lived in this country for 7 years, had paid their taxes, and were people of good moral character and had no criminal records. But they were able to apply for residency. So because these people that now have TPS, especially in our community, and I don't know that anybody is really talking about even, I mean, there's a human side to it, of course, but there's also an economic side that our area will be quite affected from that if all of a sudden all Salvadorans with TPS have to leave this country in 18 months, because I would think that our housing market would be affected. I would think that a lot of cars might be repossessed. a lot of stores might close down, restaurants might close down. There are employers around here that have talked to me and have said all their, like, it's like some, you know, labor-type jobs, but all their supervisors have TPS, and they've all had TPS, and it's the same people for 10 years, and so those are not easily replaced, and so those companies will suffer. And so there would be easy, not easy fixes, but easy solutions to those people who've been here for a long time and have integrated and been part of our community now and our daily lives, and I believe make Northwest Arkansas richer culturally and more exciting and vibrant. And the other thing would probably be to bring the visa bulletin numbers, the numbers I was talking about, the wait times, down to a minimum. And I think that would eliminate a lot of people crossing the borders and people waiting in line and waiting their turn and doing it the right way or whichever way one wants to say. But that would eliminate a lot of that too.
Is part of the problem with the quote-unquote waiting in line the fact that we don't have enough people to process all the paperwork?
No, I don't think that's the problem. I think, I mean, I know that the government officers are understaffed. I do know that. But I think there is some sort of quota system, and I don't really know what the quota system is on how many people can come. And I think they, yeah, I don't know how the numbers come about. They sometimes move up, sometimes they go back, sometimes they become unavailable altogether. And so sometimes you have to check every month, can I apply now? Because if you don't apply that month, you might not be able to apply the next month if they regress again.
How do you even begin to keep up with that?
You just check the visa bulletin every month.
And how does one do that? Online?
Yeah, online. You just Google Visa Bulletin and it just comes right up. I'll show you right here. So it's issued by the Department of State that issues the Visa Bulletin. And then you can look on here and see, like, this tells you what all the categories are of people that you can apply for. And so you can look right here. So right now, if you are from China, they're actually pretty okay. But you applied for your child as a U.S. citizen and that child's over 21, they can come to the United States if you applied for them prior to March 15th of 2011. For Mexico, it's prior to July 1st of 1996. So I guess we're almost at over 20 years right now. For the Philippines, at some point, this category down here was like 84 or something, like 30 years of a wait.
So people that applied that long ago are just sitting around waiting.
Correct.
So if I were to apply to it today, then it's obviously a lot longer than that.
Yes. If you apply today for your, let's say you apply for your brother and your brother is from Mexico, then you have about a 21-year wait.
Hence why it might seem more appealing to forego the paperwork.
Correct.
Well, thank you so much for trying to explain a very complicated topic. And if anything changes, we'll come back and ask you for some more information.
Sounds good.
That was Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda speaking with Springdale-based immigration lawyer Laura Ferner last week. You can find out more about the United States immigration system at USCIS.gov.
91.3 is supported by Pack Rat Outdoor Center in Fayetteville, dedicated to environmental responsibility and serving Northwest Arkansas since 1973. Pack Rat, offering clothing and footwear for urban and backcountry adventures, including camping, climbing, paddling, backpacking, and traveling. 521-6340, packratoc.com, or Facebook for more. Additional local support provided by David Adams, designer and creator of fine jewelry. David features reticulated metals and patinas in silver and 18 karat with bezel set diamonds, plus gemstone cuff bracelets. All pieces are handmade at the Fayetteville Square Studio. davidadams.com for more. The Trillium Salon Series presents the Chamber Music of Florence Price Wednesday, February 21st at 7 p.m. at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville. Performers include U of A professor Jean Kong with KUAF of Notes Katie Henriksen as host. Price, an Arkansas native, is the first African-American woman in history to have her work performed by major symphony. Registration is free and available at crystalbridges.org under the calendar tab.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Happy Fat Tuesday. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Pastor Clint Schneckloth, who is the lead pastor at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Tomorrow begins Lent. That will last until Easter.
Yes.
I have those facts correct.
You have the facts correct.
40 days?
40 days. But it's not. And it is.
Okay. So it is, but it isn't. Tell me about the isn't part.
Oh, well, just the math is that you don't count the Sundays.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So it's, yeah, it's...
All right. There's one perspective of Lent, and that is, I got to give something up. A sort of negative connotation. The idea is, I think, ultimately a little bit more positive. What do you gain personally, spiritually? What could society gain through sacrifice? Do I have that right and wrong?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, you have it right.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to do this at church, for example, this year. There's the negative that we're going to give up, which is actually we decided to close down our coffee hour during Lent. We have this stand at mm-hmm. church where there's mm-hmm. coffee and then people bring in treats.
And you're not going to do that for 4 Sundays.
Right. And in place of it, so there's your giving up, mm-hmm. right? But then mm-hmm. in place of it, we're setting up these 3 stands about organizations that provide for those in need, especially hunger. And so there's going to be a little stand there about ELCA World Hunger, which is our denomination's hunger appeal. And then Samaritan out of Springdale.
Springdale, right.
And then we're going to feature the University of Arkansas food pantry.
Right.
And then people, when they go by, they gave up coffee. They're not having any treats. Maybe they'll be disappointed, but then there'll be this reframing and they'll be like, oh, okay, instead I can give when I would have had this habit of eating a chocolate bar and instead, you know, donate to the food pantry. Or
I like the term reframing.
Yeah. Yeah,
that seems a little bit more approachable maybe than sacrifice or giving up.
Yes.
Let me see if this misses the mark, because this is Fat Tuesday, and often a lot of people celebrate Fat Tuesday. This is the blowout, right? I'm about to go into these 40 days, so let's take those vices. I'm not going to have fried food. Bring on the fried food.
Right.
I'm not going to drink beer. Bring on the keg. Does that miss the mark?
It sounds to me like you think it does.
I don't know. I'm not saying that I've never participated in indulgence. That's not what I'm saying. I don't know. I mean, does that miss the mark that, okay, I'm about to do this, which is more determined and more thoughtful, but I'm going to get stuff out of my system?
I know for sure that some things I've heard people do or see in, say, New Orleans mm-hmm. on Mardi Gras, from my perspective, they missed the mark.
Okay. To each their own, but from where we sit.
Yeah, right. You know, yes, they seem to be a little beyond. The idea that there are seasons of feast and there are seasons of famine and having, like, intentional communal feasting like that, I don't think that part misses the mark. I think there's some real wisdom there. I think that there's some kind of like flat austerity that got introduced by our form of Protestantism mm-hmm. that squashed that kind of stuff. You know, what we've done on some levels, this is a kind of a philosophical point that maybe some people would debate, but I wonder if having a culture that was founded by Puritanism and Western Protestantism sliced the ends off. So we don't fast very well, and we don't feast very well. And so I wouldn't want to be too critical of, like, say, Mardi Gras or Roman Catholic culture, because I think Roman Catholic culture has maintained a different sensibility about around those bodily practices. If you want to take this to the spiritual level and religious level, the fascinating part would be to pay attention to how Jesus talks about this in the Gospels. And if you remember, one of the things that happens in the Gospels is Jesus is regularly criticized for being a partier. He's at parties a lot. And he sometimes feasts and eats at inappropriate times. Mm-hmm. Like at one point, for example, they're going through a field on the Sabbath and they're like gleaning grain as they go and eating it. And they're criticized for that because that's considered to be like work on the Sabbath. And he compares himself, this is really radical, to David when David was on the outs with Saul and was fleeing. You know, he was like not a mercenary force, but like a, anyway, he had a little paramilitary group and they had gotten to the temple and they stole food off the altar. And it was justified because David was anointed of God and was leading this campaign to like reclaim Israel or whatever. So the writers were on the side of David, but Saul rightly was criticizing David for you shouldn't take food from the altar of the Lord. And then Jesus is now walking through this field, gleaning this food with his disciples. And the Sabbath keepers, people who are responsible for maintaining the law, are like, why are you working and eating this food on the Sabbath day? And Jesus's response is this really quirky response. He's like, you know, you wouldn't fast when you were with the groom at the wedding banquet. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not the right time to fast.
Right.
You should eat and feast. Well, I'm here. So we're feasting now. There will be a time for fasting, and that's going to come. So in that sense, what Lent does is it enacts that biblical story. While Jesus is there with them and doing the earthly ministry, feast, go to the parties, eat the food or whatever. But then there's going to come a moment, Ash Wednesday, when you turn, Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem. He begins to fast and pray and commit himself even more to this intense kind of set of spiritual practices, often in opposition to the religious authorities, and it's that which gets him killed and put up on the cross. So as weird as that sounds, the way they're doing things in New Orleans and then giving up meat or whatever is trying to bodily live out that gospel story.
Pastor Clint Schneckloth is lead pastor at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville. As always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Leetown is a historic settlement in Benton County that was present during the Battle of Pea Ridge. Shortly after the Civil War, though, it mostly disappeared. But since the mid-20th century, historians have attempted to interpret what Leetown might have been like.
We don't have any historical documentary agreement on how many buildings make up Leetown or where those buildings were or what those buildings functioned as. And so this is one of the ways that archaeology can easily contribute beyond the historical documentary record. We're very good at finding lost things. And so what we are trying to do there is find as many of those structures as we can and talk about how they were used and when they were used.
On the latest Short Talks from the Hill, Jamie Brandon, archaeologist with the Arkansas Archaeological Survey, talks about Leetown, bluff shelters, and what work the survey does for all Arkansans. You can find the program under the Local and Podcast tab at KUAF.com.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Eureka Springs. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. We'll end with music from the band Vintage Pistol. They'll be at George's Majestic Lounge Saturday night. You can learn more at georgesmajesticlounge.com or at the Vintage Pistol Facebook page. This is a song they recorded inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio for us, titled There's a Flame. Have a great rest of your Tuesday.
There's a flame, won't go out. about